welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be meeting filmmaker Eugene Jaracki to hear about his new documentary about Elvis and the American Dream, The King.
We'll also be welcoming back musician Chilly Gonzalez, who's a busy man. He's a new album, Solo Piano 3, on the way, plus a new film about his career and tour dates too. He'll be with us later in the programme.
And we'll be hearing from acclaimed producer Beatrice Dion about performing at Berlin's iconic Autumnal Festival.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Paige Reynolds will be looking ahead to next week's news today. And Fernando will enjoy some more great music too. That is all ahead on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are, Sunday lunchtime, in the big old Monocle Weekly chairs. A pleasure to have your company, and quite the week. One way we can make sense, certainly, of the next 7 days is to consult the Oracle. Let's call her in. It's Monocle's Paige Reynolds.
Everybody's talking front page news.
Front page news. Paige, do you see what we've done there?
That was amazing. I'm glad I didn't hear it before I came in.
No, exactly. We keep these surprises up our sleeves.
Lovely.
And it's next week's news today. What have we got this week? What do we need to be looking out for?
The first thing on my agenda is happening this Wednesday on the 29th, and it's the first televised debate between Cynthia Nixon and current New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. So this is sort of the culmination of a pretty sour back and forth between the two candidates for the last 3 months. Cynthia Nixon announced her candidacy in March, and she's really been pushing Cuomo to actually have a public debate with her about all the issues. And for me, I'm really not sure what's going to happen yet. I don't think she's got the support that she's really needs in order to sort of kick him out of place. I mean, he's been there for 8 years. He's sort of like tips to potentially be a candidate for 2020. He's really like a politician's politician. And I think she's very socially progressive and she's sharp-tongued, but I don't know what's going to happen kind of at the end of the day. But what I think is interesting is that sort of whether she gets in or not, a lot of people are talking about the Cynthia effect. So the fact that she has been pushing for Cuomo to be more socially progressive actually has materialised in some quite meaningful things. So Cuomo sort of almost reversed back on his opposition to legalising marijuana. And he's also vowed to use his powers to try and get 35,000 felons their voting rights back. So whether she goes in or not, I think it's important that she sort of pushing for a more democratic Democrat.
What next?
Next, we're going to go to another thing that's kicking off on Wednesday on the European side of the world, and that is the Venice Film Festival. So the 75th annual Venice Film Festival starts on the 29th and wraps up on September 8th. It looks like it's going to be a good one. I mean, I think that the Venice Film Festival sort of was losing a little bit of its way in past years, but obviously last year's Golden Lion winner, The Shape of Water, won at Venice and then also picked up the Oscar. So I think the sort of interest is coming back and I think the prestige is coming back. Also, what's really interesting about this year's Venice Film Festival and what we sort of found out at the end of last week is there's going to be a media embargo. Basically, people that are watching the films at those festivals aren't going to be able to tweet about them. And I think, for me, I see that as a really good sign. So they're only allowed to talk about it after a public premiere.
Time for one more, Paige?
So one more story, and this is something that's happening today, and that is the start of Burning Man Festival. Actually, before I call it a festival, when I first went onto the website, the first thing you see is Burning Man is not a festival. Instead, it's this sort of like artistic cooperative and a temporary settlement of people. So once sort of a hippie hangout, I think now you get everyone from sort of festival diehards to venture capitalists and celebrities, and there's 70,000 attendees who all flock to a small corner of Nevada to a temporary Black Rock City community. So that will last until September 4th.
Thanks, Paige. That's next week's news today here on the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, as we've been hearing earlier, we'll talk to Eugene Jaracki about his new Elvis documentary, The King. Filmmaker Eugene Jaracki has turned his documentary camera to topics ranging from the US military-industrial complex in Why We Fight to his home nation's war on drugs and the difficult questions that raised in The House I Live In.
And now he's filmed another unflinching documentary about a different American icon, Elvis Presley. But his film, The King, is no straight life story. It ties the idea of the American dream to its subject, who in later years was seen by some as a bloated cliché compared to his glorious former self. Many of the interviews in the film actually take place in the 1963 Rolls-Royce, once owned by the King of Rock and Roll. Eugene joins us in the studio now. But first, let's hear a clip.
The King sat in this car.
Now, this is amazing.
I feel like Elvis Presley left a spirit that inspires me.
You have no idea of how hard he hit American culture.
Elvis was a hero the most, but he never meant shit to me. Straight up racist, that sucker was simple and plain. Mother f*** him and John Wayne.
Elvis had was black and it was white. It's all mixed up together.
He was the voice of the country at its best and at its worst.
And Eugene Jarecki joins us now. Eugene, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Great to be here.
Thanks for coming to see us. Let me ask you, first of all, about this film. Watching it, it's a masterful portrait, both of Elvis and of the country. But there's something, and I don't know if this is a statement more about the politics of America right now, but there's a melancholy and there's this sort of Ozymandias feel about it. Did you set out to do that, or did it become an inescapable narrative as you made the piece?
Well, when we began, I mean, I had seen that there was a metaphoric power in looking at Elvis Presley and the country he left behind. And so we started out to make a poetic look at the sort of metaphor of Elvis, which inevitably has a demise at the end of it. But it rises beautifully and majestically, as America did. And it sort of then plateaus and finds itself tangled in unexpected power. You know, Elvis suddenly had the world in his hand when he was just virtually an adolescent. And what's more American than that, really? That's the story of the country. And then from there, it's a slippery slope into all that self-medication and the sort of effort to cure those ills that he had inherited. And America has had so much of that. So there was always a poetic and rather melancholy underpinning to it all. But we started making this film before the contemporary crisis that America is now gripped in. You know, that man who occupies the Oval Office, he was just a nuisance to New Yorkers at that time and a failed kind of real estate person who had a reality show. He wasn't the threat to humanity that he's become. So we, in an accidental way, kind of predicted that by setting out to cross the country, and we'll talk about how, but to cross the country and really take stock of things, how they got to that point where then that was possible, that he then ran for office and that it went the way that it did, suggested that a lot of our concerns about America, the things that we were most poignantly focused on, suddenly were coming to pass, as if the end of the story was being written while we were still just trying to catch up with it. I hadn't expected that kind of a demise to suddenly be thrust upon us. Mm-hmm. I was making a love letter, and a love letter like Tough Love that says, hey, I love you, America, but you need therapy. You are crazy on power and money. This is getting out of control. And then in walks the human embodiment of how catastrophic power and money can be in a democracy.
And Eugene, it's interesting you said tough love because, you know, of course, the film, in a way, usually documentaries like this, they are love letters, you know, to the artist. But there's quite a lot of criticism against the artist itself, you know, the way they mimic, you know, the black sound at the time. There's been some talk about cultural appropriation. So was that your intentions, or to give voice as well for people, not only saying, oh, Elvis was a megastar, he's the king and everything?
Well, can you imagine anything more boring than hearing a bunch of people talk over and over in a puff piece about a celebrity? We've had enough of that as a civilization. So for me, I'm only ever interested in textured subjects. And if I do find love, I have deep love of Elvis Presley, but my love of Elvis Presley is the kind of love I would want someone to have for me. The people who tell you that everything you do is right and nothing you do is wrong, those people killed Elvis. So if you want to save Elvis, if you want to step into history and in some sort of reach back in time and intervene, you've got to be willing to tell him, where is this leading? This is not a road to anywhere. This power and money is destroying that which made you beautiful and enduring for the time that it did. It'll undo you. And I want to do that toward Elvis in retrospect, but I was trying to do it in contemporary America. I wanted to intervene between America and the power and the money that is destroying her.
Eugene, let me ask you a bit about one of the vehicles, and it's a slightly clunky pun from me, that you used to undertake this journey, which is, of course, this 63 Rolls-Royce, which is an amazing thing. Very different, the dynamics of your subjects as they get in and out. Some people are literally sort of moved to tears. Others find it really interesting. As the sort of journey, literal and metaphorical, continued, Did that tell you anything about the nature of what it is to, I guess, be American, the pursuit? You know, there's this interesting point in there about the pursuit of happiness, but, you know, the only country where that pursuit is enshrined, if you like. Is it a sort of an empty promise? Does it suggest that these peaks and troughs we have are cyclical? I don't know. As you went on that journey, did your expectation, were they fulfilled?
That's central to the poetry of Elvis Presley. Because, look, Elvis Presley is the embodiment for so many people of the American dream. But there's a contradiction in it because, yeah, he comes out of nowhere and he can rise to unimaginable heights. But the American dream wasn't for everybody. That could happen for him because he was a white guy. It wouldn't have happened for a woman. It wouldn't have happened for black people. It didn't happen for so many people. So first of all, there's a contradiction in him embodying the American dream because the American dream is itself contradictory. Then comes the Rolls-Royce itself. The Rolls-Royce as a vehicle was not an accidental vehicle for us. It's not like, you know, oh, why didn't you, David Simon, the creator of The Wire, is in the film. And he says to me, he's a super smart guy. And he says, why didn't you take one of his Cadillacs or a Thunderbird or, you know, convertible old Detroit car? Well, for a very specific reason, those are American dream machines. They drink the Kool-Aid. You watch those cars enough with their candy colored and their chrome and the sky is blue and it goes on forever and it's mom and pop at the white picket fence. That's a dream that America has promoted to the world, but it's not the actuality for Americans. What's actual is to drive an Elvis Presley's 1963 Rolls-Royce and realize the unbelievable mind the gap, to put it in British terms, that class gap issue that is so dominant in the country. Elvis became a king, and that is contradictory to the values of a democracy. A democracy, a republic like America, is not supposed to become an empire ruled by an oligarchy, and a country boy is not supposed to become a king. We're supposed to love country boys. Look, he can get a little famous, he can get some money, but he's supposed to love his mom, which he did. He's supposed to still barbecue in the backyard, which kind of stopped doing because Graceland's a bit of a castle and because it all got very rarefied. So to have this king, this boy king, lost in the big back seat of this gilded cage, that was the poetry of driving that Rolls-Royce across America for Elvis. For America, we drove that car into places like the south side of Memphis and the poor parts of Tupelo, Mississippi, and things like this, where people would come out and they would look at it like it had landed from another planet. Mm. The socioeconomics are such that they've never even seen a car like that. And isn't that symbolic of that true story of the American dream?
I just wonder about this sort of them and us narrative, because that's very much what we come back to in this country at the moment with Brexit and all this nonsense, and certainly in the States with Trump, this idea of them and us and this divide. Can you explain from the journey you went on how the manifestation of that is Trump? You know, he's the gilded, he's the 1% of the 1%, and yet he's supposedly the voice of the disenfranchised. Right. How did that specific failure come about?
I think it happened in America the same way it happened here and the same way it's happening in Europe. When the rich and powerful abuse systems that are supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people, those people become desperate, heartbroken, and they reach out for all manner of fix, just like Elvis reached out for every quick fix he could find, from drugs to carbohydrates to vanity, violence, whatever. And they find false gods. And it's like any kind of an abused person who reaches out for anybody. You know, you've been abused so long, you say, look, the next fool that walks in that door saying anything different than the status quo I've been fed, whether they feed me Brexit, whether they feed me austerity, whether they feed me the crap that that guy in the Oval Office fed them, it's all charlatan talk, but you go for it because you're desperate. And they went for him by enough numbers. It wasn't a majority, but they went for him by enough numbers to get it within a stone's throw, maybe a Russian stone's throw of a connivance, right? So maybe it was close enough even to get to that. But that tells you how broken it is. We've all known abused people, and you know that when they break out and they want to find the next, the sort of the new thing, they end up with the rebound guy. And very often the rebound guy is worse than before because they haven't solved the inner crisis within themselves. So when I wanted to write a love letter to America that said, you need to go to therapy, you need to look at what is driving you into the ground as a country, which is this elevation of power and money. I mean, think about it this way. The framers of the country, they broke off from the King of England saying no more kings and queens. We're done with that stuff. Look at how many Americans today watch the royal wedding, are glued to the tube to watch the royal wedding. Look at how many people watch The Crown. Americans are in love with royalism, both in Jay-Z, Beyonce, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie terms, and also even in the British royal family. The framers would come back and be mortified. They'd think, why did we dump that tea in the ocean if these knuckleheads are sitting here still glued to this stuff? So what does it tell you is that our basic national identity, the of the people, by the people, for the people, part of how we were founded, is a confusion right now torn inside a person reaching out for the rebound guy. So we right now have extremely abusive, just told you what you wanted to hear, rebound guy in the Oval Office meeting people on the street who just desperately wanted a new way that was fairer to them.
And Eugenia, I want to talk as well about the incredible appearances of the film. I mean, you have, you know, of course, some Elvis biographers, you have Chuck D, but also some quite unusual characters. I have to be honest, I was not expecting Mike Myers, certainly, to give his views on Elvis Presley. Yes. Tell us, how was the process of getting those interesting figures in the film?
A lot of it is sort of a great casting office in the sky, where once you start to make a movie, if you're open, and we don't start with a script and we don't start with a plan, we roll into a place like Nashville and we didn't even know anybody. And some hours later, all of a sudden, John Hyatt is sitting in the back of our car and he bursts into tears being inside Elvis's roles and what it meant to him. Or Emmylou Harris happened to be doing a show, so one person told another person she should jump in the car and talk to us. So a lot of it was chance and sort of good kismet. But a lot of it had to do with, in each place, I wanted to find seminal people who I thought understood the Elvis narrative or the American narrative today in a different way. Mike Myers is from Canada. He knows more about the British invasion as Austin Powers than almost any living person because he's obsessed with it. And the British invasion had a big role in the sort of in putting Elvis out to pasture. There's a lot of stories about when the Beatles came to find Elvis, and they find that he's kind of this has-been, this guy that they idolized. If you look at the early pictures of the Beatles, they're all trying to be Elvis, and they finally meet him. And I had found this incredible piece of footage of him singing Yesterday. So in front of them, he's suddenly sitting there singing, "I'm not half the man I used to be." And to them, he's not. Well, Mike Myers tells that story so beautifully. So I had been told by various people, this is a guy you've got to get. This is a woman you have to have. This is a person who knew him or knows the American story in an interesting way. And it was one thing led to another. So a lot of it was just on the merits of what somebody had to offer.
And a little serendipity, always a good thing to have, I guess, in your production locker. Yeah. Can I ask you, Eugene, I mentioned and reeled off a couple of your former credits in the introduction. You're unafraid of tackling difficult subjects, and indeed subjects that you almost know are going to upset a lot of people. Has this one, I don't know, it's obviously kind of going out into the world, but have you been surprised by the degree to which people are delighted or upset by your vision on this? Because I guess Elvis, a bit like drugs or the military-industrial complex, he's a divisive character, remains so.
He's an institution, and I've never received more hate mail on a movie than I have for this movie. And I wrote an editorial in America that just said, why do some people hate my movie so much? And it has to do with, they'd only seen the trailer, by the way. Most people who I see.
For these people, that's enough though, isn't it?
It's enough, yeah. Because in the echo chamber of the internet, in the filter bubbles we live in, a trailer tells you everything, because what would more content do except confuse you, right? So we had a lot of people reacting to the trailer. And I think it's the moment they saw Chuck D come on in the trailer and say a couple of curse words in and around conversation about Elvis. They thought, okay, Eugene is out for everything that's great and good in America, he's going to take it down. So we don't want to hear this. Now, what was interesting about that is that I think that it's part of the tragedy of our time. It's part of how that whole charlatan routine goes on. You know, you guys had it in this country where the public was clearly misled and fooled into a corner that they now don't know how to get back out of. Because once you fool people, they have to be willing to say, "I was fooled," to get back out of that corner. And that's a whole new thing, where now you're asking the public not only to be humiliated by you once, but now to humiliate themselves and say, "I might have been fooled on this thing." Nobody wants to admit that. So that's a big part of what I think goes on. But the negative reaction started in America when people saw the trailer, but has been kind of overwhelmed by the reaction to the film itself, which has been glowingly positive. I think when people see the film, they realize it's a rather comprehensive, loving portrait of a man in a country that isn't just some simplistic rap in one way or another. I'm not an Elvis biopic. I'm not an anti-Elvis film. I'm a road trip across America in his car with a lot of music playing.
What would you think Elvis would be doing in the Trump era?
Well, he wouldn't be doing what the man who's, I don't use this guy's name because I don't want to promote his brand anymore. I think it's failing. But I think that those guys in the Oval Office who are running that part of the country right now, they would like to think that Elvis represents the sort of big white men that they represent. Elvis was a rather progressive person who, among other things, was deeply connected to the black community, played black music, loved black musicians, loved black culture. And, for example, the racism that's patently on display in the Oval Office in this country would have run very, very, very against Elvis's ethics. I also think it's best to be understood that, and I will say his name for this, I think Donald Trump is the embodiment of everything that destroyed Elvis Presley. And I think he's the embodiment of everything that will destroy America if he's not brought down. And that is to say, axiomatically, that the fall of Trump will be the rise of Elvis. It will be a restoration of those of the people, by the people, authenticity values that everyone does care about America for, and that is a part of our story. We've had other parts of our story that are toxic and that are problematic. That one had some realness to it. The stuff I don't like, that black people didn't have rights, that women didn't have rights, that came from Europe. That was still going on all over the world. America didn't invent that stuff. We just were the constant staging ground of it never being solved. But we brought these new ideas that came with the framers and came with the Enlightenment, and I think those are deeply valuable. I think Elvis represents those in a beautiful accidental way. The current inhabitant of the Oval Office is a toxic enemy of all that. And we stand at a crossroads in history that's either going to prevail, his brand of toxicity, or he's going to go down and every newspaper in the world will say, you're fired.
Eugene, what about this idea? We started off by talking about the melancholy, this sense of emptiness, which I think you capture so elegantly, both with the music, with the shots, with the words that people say in the film. I don't want to be sort of relentlessly downbeat generally about the state of the world, but how much more emptiness is there for us to kind of bleed into? It feels rather unfortunate. I don't know. Are there kernels of optimism that we could see something more positive? Yeah, and after the very worst, you get back to the very best?
Even without a downfall, I'm incredibly optimistic right now. And the reason I am.
Well, yeah, can you tell us why? Because
sure.
But that might surprise people if you
didn't
tell people. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And I hope people get it from the film in a way. The music and the performers and the dignity of people that's on display in the film, whether it's Chuck D or whether it's Emmylou Harris or whether it's the young girl Emmy Sunshine, these incredible performers from Memphis, these African American soul singers. There's so many people in the film that give you the flame of human dignity that you can't extinguish no matter how crooked you are. That's one thing. But what's more significant, I think, is that since we premiered the film at the Cannes Film Festival a year ago. And when I came on stage there, this guy had just been elected. The whole world looked like a stunned deer. They were all wondering, where is this going? And I had to stand on a stage, and I thought I was showing this love letter to Elvis and America. And instead, I got the feeling that people thought I'd made an autopsy for the American dream. Like, if the metaphor holds, we had just died on the toilet like Elvis on election night. Well, the truth is, since that time, I've had an incredible rebirth of optimism. I kept working on the film. It's become a very different film. But that happened because I watched that. Think about it this way. This guy is the worst possible political development imaginable in centuries. There's no question, but no reason to debate that, that we're done with that question. But what's happened on his watch is as inspiring as he is horrible. Because in counter-reaction to him, we have seen the birth of the most significant social movements in my lifetime. Me Too, Time's Up, the Poor People's Movement, the mayoral protections of sanctuary cities protecting immigrants in a way that had never been done before. Thousands and thousands of people going to airports on behalf of refugees and immigrants. The strikes in red states, strikes for teachers that we haven't seen in generations. There are 17 states today where prisoners are striking in America. These are motions of democracy, glimmers of democracy, that you probably saw most clearly embodied in the Parkland students when they stood up, Emma Gonzalez and her partners in tragedy, and they all stood up in defense of their fallen comrades against the most powerful, pernicious institution we have, the NRA. That's democracy. You know, they always say in the protests, this is what democracy looks like. That's what democracy looks like. So it's been amazing because in the worst of times, this era of this guy and all the cabal around him, you also see the best in human nature and that indefatigable spirit that is why we believe democracy has power.
Amazing. And it is interesting you're talking about optimism. There's a scene in the film, I think he's a driver, road crew driver,
yeah.
And then you ask him about the state of America. I kind of agree with him. I mean, he doesn't say it's like downfall, but he says it's kind of stagnant, you know,
right.
But there is a little sense of optimism there.
Well, bear in mind, he said that before this happened.
Oh.
Right? We're driving across the country in a country where we think this place is falling apart, an election is happening, boy, are things coming apart at the seams. But if you would ask him how he feels today, he'd be like, okay, we have just gone to the wall here. But that wall is a fascinating place because the biggest problem in America, it's like the neoliberalism of Europe. America has been feeding us Kool-Aid for decades and decades that it's all working well, and don't look too close under the hood at the engine. Don't worry about how it's running. Well, right now, we understand. We wake up every morning to understand that a catastrophically non-democratic system is running. That's very important because that's what's waking people up, and it's causing democracy to be rekindled in the hearts of people, which is where it truly belongs.
Eugene, it's fabulous to speak with you. Thanks very much for coming to see us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And Eugene's brilliant documentary, The King, is out now. This is the Monocle Weekly, here on Monocle 24. Fernando, it's virtually impossible to watch The King, or for that matter, to talk to Eugene, and not have your head filled with, I don't know, glorious tracks from the man himself, all the influences, there's so much wonderful music. I think, though, it's only fitting that we play a little Elvis right now.
It is Suspicious Minds.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me?
There was Elvis there from 1969 with Suspicious Minds, which is one of my favorites, don't I have to say. And I'll stay with us for more music in a minute when we'll be hearing from Chilly Gonzalez. Paris-based Canadian musician Chilly Gonzalez, given name Jason Beck, has been making tunes ranging from outsider art prank hip-hop in the early noughties to melodic cameos on records ranging from Drake to Daft Punk, and his solo piano albums show off his virtuoso skills on the keys.
He's just about to release Solo Piano 3. He's also got a documentary about his career, Shut Up and Play the Piano, directed by Philip Yedeker, and he has a frighteningly long list of tour dates kicking off from the end of this month all the way through to next year. Monocle's Tom Hall sat down with Chilly earlier to talk about it all, beginning with that new record, the third in his solo piano series.
Well, third and final installment in the solo piano trilogy. I just can't imagine being excited about something called Solo Piano 4, so it just felt like it should end. People who know my work, most people, I think, understand this is maybe me at my most idealistic. I've noticed that when people talk about these albums, they talk in a different way, in hushed tones. You really helped me get through something. And that's wonderful to hear, all joking aside. I noticed it on the first record, which was essentially an accidental album. I just was noodling on a piano and was recording to basically let off some steam while I was simultaneously producing an album for Jane Birkin,
who was as you did,
as I was doing back in 2003.
Indeed,
it was like working in the royal court for Jane Birkin. There's many people around her. You can't really speak your mind. It's not really the kind of exuberant studio experience that I was used to. It was, you know, tight sphincters everywhere, and I just needed to go loosen up. And so I went to this other room where there was a piano and some microphones. I just started noodling around, and I thought, well, maybe I'll put this out. Maybe, you know, at that time I was mostly doing electro rap, so to speak, very much personality-based stuff, extreme performance art, mostly in Berlin. So at that moment I thought, okay, this will be an interesting curio for some of my fans maybe, but I didn't really anticipate that it would open up all these other doors. And so you can never recreate that surprise, can you? So to do a solo piano 3 at this point, there's no way to sort of connect with that naive side in myself. So this is a wise man's piano album, essentially, because that's the only other option. You're either a beginner or you're like a Zen master. This is the Zen master part of what I do. However, I make sure I always have beginner's mind projects going on, whether it's making the Ivory Tower movie or a book of easy piano pieces or the conservatory, my music school. All those things are to get me back to that solo piano one thing where let me just try something that I don't know how to do, that I have literally have no expectation of how it will go. And that's a beautiful thing. So to be doing Solo Piano 3, it's in a way the hardest thing to talk about and the hardest thing to share my excitement about, because it's coming from such a different place.
I'm interested in the format of the solo piano albums because the pieces, they're all quite short. They're almost like teasers sometimes. And I think there's two things in my mind going on there. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I just wish that went on a bit longer. But I'm also of the school where I like leaving people wanting more and simplicity as well. I also wonder that people see an album like this, they might see it almost in the sort of canon of like traditional classical composing, because that's the sort of layman's perception of what might be going on here. But I find it also like a really kind of modern thing, because I know that some of these pieces get sampled, the likes of Drake and other people have used these as loops. And are you aware that people have like an attention span of a gnat these days, and these are sort of meant to be bite-sized chunks of emotion, and you're sort of trying to funnel something incredibly efficient into them?
Well, I have the attention span of a gnat, so I make music that I want to hear. I don't have the patience for deeply structured classical music. In classical music, there were monumental pieces, and those were mostly written in an attempt to join the canon of composers. So you have like sonatas, multi-movement pieces where, unless you're really inducted into the mechanics of composition, it's kind of hard to follow. I grew up with pop music. So the kind of classical music I liked was like not those sonatas. What I liked were the miniatures. Miniatures were written by composers whose names we've mostly forgotten now. And they were written in a very sort of condescending way for girls. Because girls couldn't handle sonatas, you see. So they could handle a short 2 or 3 page piece lasting 2 or 3 minutes with just 1 or 2 good ideas. Waltzes, quadrillas, things like this. That's actually my wheelhouse. I have the taste of a 19th century girl when it comes to classical music. And so I'm kind of representing for the miniature. I'm kind of representing for what pop music was in its earliest form, essentially. I want my music to fit with people's playlists. And if they're going from a James Blake song to a Gucci Mane song, if one of my piano songs comes on in between, I want to feel like it fits. It should feel almost like, when's the next Gucci Mane beat going to drop on top of this piano song? It never does, but it's always threatening to, in my mind. It's always threatening to become a modern song. The idea that I would be some sort of like gateway drug to actual classical music is really far off the mark. I don't listen to that much classical music, to be honest. Like I said, I like the miniatures, but I like to represent what I hear in the modern pop, rap, electronic landscape. I like to use that to inform how I make my piano pieces. I want to be a man of my time as I scream from the hilltops for 10 years.
You're kind of known also, I mean, you're a very eloquent, civilized speaker on your music now, but when you perform, you have a much different persona on stage. And I don't know whether that feels natural or whether it feels performative or whether it feels fun or whether
you want me to have a tantrum right here?
Yeah, basically.
You just gotta poke the beast. It's going to happen.
Where does that line sort of, is it a conscious decision or is it something where if I say that your album is crap enough, you will come out with the guns?
Well, you know, crap is just rap with a C, so... I would say that to do an interview is to sort of get to 3 or 4 out of 10 on the persona scale. But of course, when you're in front of a couple thousand people and you're actually playing your own music, it becomes more like a fantasy that I get to live in reality. And it gets reinforced by applause. And the more I show them even darker or more uncomfortable parts of my personality, the more they seem to forgive me, the more they seem to love me, either in spite of or maybe even because of living out this fantasy, living out this dream of impunity and dominance and having everyone's attention on me. I'm not a very confrontational person in real life. Maybe I wish I were more confrontational. Well, the stage is a place where you can sort of live out how you'd love to be able to live.
No way, no how, I could never disappoint a crowd, my God. I just play what they want like a jukebox or an iPad. Got a song here, play a show there, wanna tell my dad so there. Now that I got what I want, I'll be honest, I'm so scared.
That's a very seductive and reinforcing relationship with the audience that is wonderful, but of course also is not how most people live. So there is a danger at some point where you think, I mean, in my case, there were a few years there where I thought, I just like this better. Can't I kind of be this way all the time? And in a way, the Chilly Gonzalez way of being on stage would sort of bleed into other aspects of my life. And it wasn't a positive development. And that period is mostly behind me. And that might also explain why, if you see me live now, it's a more controlled version of those tantrums and those... is tantra? Tantrum? Tantra? What's the plural?
Tantra is something completely different, I think.
Okay.
Would you say you have tantric performances on stage? Is that something?
Tantric tantrums. Next album title.
But there is this competitiveness, which I think is also a really healthy part of your music. And you've done piano duels in the past with Andrew WK and others.
Beat his ass bad.
I noticed the other day, it was from a meme actually, but Vladimir Putin plays piano. Would you be up for a duel with Putin?
And so does Macron. Actually, okay. President Macron was, I think, almost concert level, because when he was a teenager, he was like excelling at theater and music and sports. Crazy. He has like a black belt in judo. And when the French won their soccer title, or football as you call it, in Moscow, the music that they played for the giving of the medals was Smothered Mate from Ivory Tower, my track produced by Boys Noise, which was written for the climactic sports confrontation in the chess movie Ivory Tower that I wrote and produced. So we wanted to make something that would feel like, you know, essentially like Rocky. And in real time, somehow it was happening, and Putin heard my music and Macron heard my music, and he was out in the rain and he was hugging the players. And it was perhaps the moment where my music was heard by the most amount of people simultaneously in my entire career. Very, very exciting and thrilling that this sort of love letter to competition sort of made it to such a real high level of competition in the world. But I would just say that I think I've gotten to a point where I like my music to go farther than myself.
Right.
I finally got to a point where I'm happy if my music is more famous than I am. And that's a shift, but the competitiveness is still there. It just shifts. And it can even lead me to do something like the conservatory, where I, you know, I have the gall now to think, okay, I changed my own life. Let me change 7 other people's lives now in 1 week.
Yeah.
So it's still a kind of, in some sense, it's a megalomaniacal proposition to do that, to think I can have a whole school now. I can invent an entire method. However, the energy is fundamentally going outward rather than just inward. And that is something that's different. And so I think that kind of energy can morph. It doesn't mean that one is better than the other, but there was just a moment where it felt like I'd had enough to eat from the hunger for recognition.
I mean, we've been talking a lot about your instrumental work and your work as a sort of almost, I don't want to say a studio expert, because that would, like, I know that might offend your artistic sensibility.
But it doesn't offend me. It's just wrong. I'm not good in the studio. I'm not good. You know why I'm not good in the studio? Because I don't like guessing in what situation people are going to hear the thing I'm working on. I like to be in front of people on stage. That's really what I'm born to do. I'm a stage expert. I'm on stage and I can read what's happening. And if something goes wrong, I can save it. I can get lost and find my way back again with evidence that this is a moment. When I'm in the studio, it's like, okay, a year from now, someone's going to hear this and I have no idea how, who, what context. Are they in the bathtub? Are they washing the dishes? Are they on a train? Are they having sex? What are they doing when they're listening to my music? It's infuriating, to be honest. So I'm not a studio expert in the least.
Well, my point was that many people who maybe have just stumbled on your work recently, they might not be quite as aware of your beginnings, which were much less, I would say, like sat at the piano in the concert hall, but more messing around on the beatboxes and rapping and doing quite a lot of prankster-esque art.
Something like performance art.
I got an extra testicle, but you're skeptical about spectacle. These days, bad taste is so delectable, and the crowd is so suggestible.
And Andy Kaufman, provocation.
And that's all documented in your new documentary, as we absolutely effortlessly come on to Shut Up and Play the Piano.
That's right.
I've watched it. I thought it was great, because I remember seeing you I think it was Manchester Student Union in about 2004 with Feist.
And I remember that gig in a big church.
Yep, indeed. Yeah. You came on and you did the whole first song. Everyone was getting into it and you were sort of taking the piss out of people that don't like write their own songs or like mime on stage. And then you put the mic down and you'd been miming the whole song like in front of everyone. And that I found that kind of genius. But your journey as a musician hasn't really been told, and maybe you've put up some barriers to that in the past around sort of your persona and stuff. So what made you want to clarify the story a bit and, you know, let people understand the journey of where you've been?
Well, I think it's what we were talking about earlier. It's really that the energy that I would put out gets, of course, reflected back at me when I'm on stage, and to put out records and to only think in terms of what's my next move, where can I take this, how can I become more and more myself. And then, as I said, there was a moment probably around 2012-13, the inevitable happened, turning around 40 years old and realizing this is not a tenable way for me to enjoy what I do forever. And so I started to think about just naturally, what's it like to push the energy out again? Things like the conservatory are a real sign of the times for me, as far as that's the project I think about when I wake up in the morning. I'm going to do it every year.
Yeah.
So I'm currently planning conservatory 2019, the second version.
This is where you gather young musicians and
where I gathered seven musicians from all over the world and spend a week sort of experimenting with techniques that I sort of arrived at over the last 15 years, little lessons I learned, some bigger than others, about how to trust yourself and write music under extreme pressure to remove that sort of self-image you have of yourself and the kind of illusion of perfectionism that you can keep on working. And the idea is to prove to you by doing it, you, the musician who have been invited to Paris, to take a real leap of faith, let yourself be filmed while doing some of the most, you know, risky and dangerous for your own sort of self-image, essentially improvising songwriting. You know, it's how I wrote Limit to Your Love with Feist. We were literally sitting there and she had a big page with a bunch of song titles. She's like, Limit to Your Love, that sounds cool. And I just went, dun, 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 dun. And she went, there's a limit to your love, right? Cue James Blake making it a hit 3 years later. That's called songing. That's just the idea that you have a song title and you basically fuse composition and performance, because what you tell yourself isn't, I'm going to compose a song now spontaneously. What you say is, we're going to perform a song spontaneously that doesn't exist yet. And that removes this strange gap between the frustration I feel when I'm like, oh, who's going to listen to this and why and when? It's just like it removes that whole barrier and gets you closer to what I think music probably was for so, so long, which was people just spontaneously making sounds to please others that were in the same room as them.
I'm sort of fascinated by where your music ends up in the places where, as you mentioned, it popped up in the prize ceremony at the World Cup, and you kind of almost sometimes write it with that in mind of almost, it's almost a gift to others to make something else out of. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean, are there any places where someone listening to this interview who's flat out never heard of you, where they will have heard your music pretty much certainly?
Well, if they listen to, you know, Drake or Daft Punk, I'm on those records popping up here and there, little piano interludes or little flourishes. You know, I had a song in the first iPad commercial. It was called Never Stop.
Yeah, know that one.
You know, so those are those Where's Waldo moments, as I called them, where I just sort of end up in an unlikely place. As I said, I used to have a frustration in those moments sometimes thinking, no one knows it's me. What about me? And now I really, through, you know, personal development and hard-earned acceptance of reality, to understand that it's also just wonderful to think that's a lot of positive energy being created in my music. That's a real moment to see, like, Macron refuse the umbrella of his handler and go in the soaking rain and hug those players. And the fact that I was soundtracking it is more than enough to feel that I'm creating positive energy with my music. That's all I can really hope for.
Chilly Gonzalez there in conversation with Monocle's Tom Hall. The new album, Solo Piano 3, is out on the 7th of September. And do look out for that excellent documentary, Shut Up and Play the Piano 2. And you can catch him live on tour, beginning in Geneva and all across Europe from the 31st of August. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Fernando, it's something of a musical bonanza on the Monocle Weekly this week.
I love it.
Okay, well, since 2013, Atonal Festival has been a mainstay of Berlin's experimental music calendar. It's a resurrection of an event that originally ran in West Berlin between 1982 and 1990, and in recent years has been staged in a huge repurposed power plant called the Kraftwerk Complex.
What a name. Among the performers at this year's festival is Beatrice Dion, a London-based musician, artist and producer. She sat down with Monocle contributor Henry Rhys Sheridan in Kraftwerk's garden to talk about Atonal and her own work, beginning with the previous night's performance.
I think it went well. There was a nice reception and there was lots of whoops and claps, which is a good signifier. I was pleased with the way it sounded, and it was a very busy room. It was very, very hot, so I was happy.
We weren't lucky enough to see it. Tell us what went on.
It was entirely new music for me. Like, I'm working on a big batch of new music at the moment, so there was nothing there that's been released or perhaps anybody's actually heard before. There was quite a lot of works in progress. And what people heard was 45 minutes of kind of rhythmic music that stays on the 150 BPM level. So it's very, very fast. But the aim with this set is to swoop around that fixed tempo. So you have a feeling that you're hearing half time, double time, triple time. It's a rhythm game, basically, for like 45 minutes. But if you break it down, it's very fast, but at times it sounds quite slow.
And more broadly, what does collaborating with visual artists bring to your work? How long have you been doing it for, and why do you continue to engage with other artists in that way?
Well, I studied fine art. I didn't study music. I've got no real sort of musical training. That's really where my kind of creative roots are, I suppose. So for me to still be connected with visual artists is to do with my friendship circles that have evolved out of being at art school, and also I'm from London. My parents also were involved in the arts and design as well, so I've been quite lucky. I've been quite submerged in culture for kind of all my life, really. So it feels very natural to me to find connections with my interests in visual artists' interests. It's just a question of finding the right people that you have like a genuine connection with and some true common ground, not just putting something together for the sake of it. So it feels very natural for me to think about music visually, or to have that, have another perspective on what you're doing from somebody else.
And do you normally approach your collaborators, or are you poached by them, or is it 50-50?
Well, it sounds a bit boastful, but I'm poached quite often, which is a nice position to be in.
Let's talk a little bit about physical environment and performance. We're outside the quite extraordinary venue where most of the action for this Atonal Festival takes place. Disused power plant called Kraftwerk here in Berlin. Did you play in the actual main hall?
So I played in the stage, which is a much more contained room with slightly lower ceilings and I think a kind of tiled wall surface. And it's much more of a sort of conventional club room than the bigger main stage, which is essentially a kind of emptied warehouse space with vast acoustics and all sorts of reverberation conditions. So, yeah, I played in actually much more of a conventional space, but it sounded good. I was really pleased. My music focuses a lot on extremes of frequency, so lots of low bass frequency and lots of high frequencies, and to be honest, not that much in the middle. So it's always touch and go whether the room is going to support that. It supported it last night.
And how much control do you have over the physical suitability of the environments in which you play? Can you alter rooms once you're in there to a degree, or do you have to kind of be selective in what gigs you agree to in the first place in order to ensure that, you know, you play in an appropriate environment which is going to do your work justice?
I wouldn't say I'm in a position to be turning down gigs because the environment is kind of not entirely perfect to the music I want to make. I'm open to that kind of challenge. I think that probably makes you a better, be a more dynamic artist, I suppose, in the long run, because you, that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with sound and the kind of reduction of that. So the more you can learn about mistakes or things that go wrong, maybe, as long as you're not just difficult and angry, if you're open to sort of like adjusting to real life situations where your music will be performed, then maybe that will kind of impact the music in a good way. So that's a way of saying it can be awkward at times if the room is unsympathetic to the sounds that you're putting in it, but there's always something to be learned from that. So I have a degree of control with what I'm doing. I mean, I use a computer, so there are constraints with using a computer, but we could also go into a whole conversation about composing music for specific spaces and what music sings in what space and why. And so you have to be a bit more on the run about these things. Something's just got to work most places, really.
How much do you know about Atonal as a festival, its kind of history, before you played it this year?
Well, I guess I've been a kind of, long-distance admirer of the festival for a while. I have a bit of a knowledge about its sort of position in the kind of development of German or European electronic music from the 80s and so on, but I would say I probably am more familiar with the more recent lineups or the artists on more recently.
I'm interested, does your kind of awareness of the history of a particular event, be it Atonal or other festivals that you may have played, other venues you might have played in, does that affect what you bring to playing there, either in terms of the composition of the music or the performance, the type of event that you hold?
Well, I guess I have a sort of admiration for, like, the lineage of Berlin techno in its broader sense. I have an admiration for it, but I don't have a total passion for it. So there are elements of that music that I have in my music, but I kind of pick and choose. So when you play here, you know that there's going to be a degree of, like, understanding of, as I said, that lineage of music is there in the crowd. They know it. They're living in it. They're standing in these venues. But I also think that Berlin is a very young audience, so people are actually quite open and broad-minded to more sort of broken, cut-up stuff, which is kind of more my approach to things, really.
What's your relationship to Berlin's music scene more broadly, kind of beyond this festival? Have you played here much?
Yeah, I've played here a few times. I've DJed here and I've played live. I'm a fan. I'm an admirer of, as I mentioned before, of that sort of history of music that's been born out of Berlin, not necessarily by Germans on their own, but by that sort of, you know, that melting pot cliche. So my kind of interest in German music, sort of maybe more German dance music, kind of is rooted in the Hardwax record store and the kind of the community that was sort of evolved from that store and around that store. So the various labels that sprung out from that. So the work by Mark Anestis and Moritz von Oswald and Basic Channel and Chain Reaction. And that was a really fertile time in German music, a very focused, very concentrated time. That was then, and this is now. There's other things happening now, which has pushed that on a bit. I would say I draw from the past and now, sort of equally. So, and I just take these two ways of thinking about music, all is the same, all the time. I'm not so bothered about just only being specifically interested in what's happening right now. I mean, in terms of sort of just thinking about my friends who are here and kind of artists that I admire who are here, artists like Laurel Halo and Mesh and Aerosmith, and there are many people that I could list actually who've thrived off this city and who've impacted this city. Bill, who runs Pan, and inspiring kind of ventures like Sarah Miles running Berlin Community Radio, and these kind of small moments where things are happening and people are kind of, you know, things are colliding, and that's inspiring to me.
You're here on a flying visit. You just named some of the acts that you kind of most admire, your friends. But I wonder, specifically out of the people who are playing here this year, who would you have liked to have seen?
If I was staying a bit longer, and if I had had time last night, I would have seen Mohammed Reza Mortazavi, who's an amazing percussionist, absolutely phenomenal percussionist. He plays a large, kind of round, not very deep hand drum. He's absolutely amazing. So beautiful, his music. Played with him actually in Switzerland, which was a great night. So yeah, I would have seen him. I would definitely see Lil Mofo, who's a fantastic DJ from Japan. She's amazing. I'd see my friend Batu, who's also a great artist, and he runs a great label called Time Dance. He's also another phenomenal DJ. I'd see DJ Marcel for just the joy of music and the range of music that can be played. Clara Lewis, probably like to see Casamoss's new set, new project, Color It. He's always got his own individual take on things. Peder Mannefeld, I mean, it's actually, it's great. I could pretty much stay here a week.
Beatrice Dillon there at Atonal Festival in Berlin in conversation with Henry Rhys Sheridan. You're with the Monocle Weekly. Fernando, there we go. The curtain drops on a sort of beautiful musical medley. We guarantee you're always going to learn something if you listen to the Monocle Weekly. There we go. What you also need to remember is to thank the right people behind the glass, the producers Tom Hall and Augustin Macellari, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Thanks also to Natalie Galpin for production assistance in Berlin. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Goodbye.